Truthspresso, episode 12.
Face it, we all would rather sleep in this morning. That's why God gave us espresso, to kickstart our zombified corpses into hyperdrive. And now, giving your mind and soul the morning shot of truth it craves. This is Truthspresso with Daniel Minnick.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to Truthspresso. I am your host, Daniel Minnick, and as of this episode, I am actually creating a series of episodes for Truthspresso centered around replying to a particular article written by a certain John Irving. Last episode, we actually started to review this article. Mr. John Irving is a novelist and a screenwriter who seems to focus his writing efforts on abortion fiction, literally. Yet, in this article by Mr. John Irving, he attempted to give pro-life advocates a history lesson. Yes, he was going to tell us, those of us who believe that life begins at conception and that we, as pro-lifers, believe that all human life is sacred and all human life deserves equal treatment under the law and should not be killed, he, Mr. John Irving, is going to tell us pro-lifers how history proves a more pro-choice position than we might actually realize. So, in other words, Mr. Irving attempted to claim that history was friendlier toward killing babies in the womb. And those of us, those people who believe that killing, that people intentionally trying to kill defenseless human lives, should look to history to see that the moral high ground is actually his position, the pro-choice position. The moral high ground is actually that intentional killing of defenseless babies in the womb should actually be allowed. However, as we examine Mr. Irving's history lesson, we will see that it is simply more of his abortion fiction. So, last, we saw that Mr. Irving focused on the historical Christian idea of quickening, and Mr. Irving really loves this term, quickening. This term, quickening, historically refers to the time during pregnancy when the mother first feels the baby move or kick in the womb. According to Mr. Irving, this is when abortion was no longer allowed, but allegedly abortion was completely fine up until this point. Some magical moment of evidence of life somehow meant that the difference between a crime and a right. Now, I granted this concept to Mr. Irving just for the sake of argument. If you haven't listened to episode 10 of Truthspresso, the last episode, I would highly recommend that you listen to that episode first so that you get a backdrop of what we're talking about and Mr. Irving's argument about history and the term quickening and what he intended for that to teach us pro-lifers who believe that life begins at conception and that we should protect innocent life in the womb. So he granted, for the sake of argument, this concept to Mr. Irving that quickening was this line of demarcation. But first, he claimed that abortion rights have been a struggle for women against men in power. While just right after that statement, he argued that colonial America was friendlier to abortion. A society that could be described as the epitome of religious men in power, as we talked about in the last episode. The second point, he made the statement that prior to what he called, in his words, modern diagnostic ultrasound, people recognized that abortion was a choice that belonged to the women. Yet, he drew absolutely no conclusion about why modern diagnostic ultrasound would affect anything. This was a complete non sequitur in Mr. Irving's mind, so it left me scratching my head wondering why would he point this out if he expects the reader to draw no conclusions from why ultrasounds might have why modern ultrasounds would have actually changed the way people treated the unborn in time. It's very strange to me. But nevertheless, we move on. So we observe that Mr. Irving's arguments in the last episode about men in power and ultrasounds were completely vacuous, they were inherently contradictory, and they really begged the question. Now, this is granting his idea that the colonialists believed that abortion was a right until this time of quickening when the mother feels the baby kick in the womb, which usually happens about halfway through pregnancy. Yet, if we walk through church history and colonial history, we will see that Mr. Irving's history lesson is nothing but abortion fiction. We will start with number one, the scriptures themselves, move on to number two, early church history, to see what some of the early Christian writers and the ones that would be called the early church fathers, what did they have to say about the topic of abortion? Number three, which we'll actually get into in the next episode, number three will cover colonial American history, and we will put Mr. Irving's assumptions about abortion rights to the test. So, number one, going on to scripture, what do the scriptures say about abortion? Well, admittedly, even as someone who is 100% pro-life, I would have to say that scriptures do not actually address the issue of abortion, you know, in and of itself. Now, I'd say that scriptures will show us how we should understand such a topic and how we should understand abortion procedures and whether they're moral or immoral and whether it is okay to kill a child in the womb in relation to the fact that that the child in the womb is a special creation of God. But nevertheless, you know, abortion is not named as such in the Bible, but we can look at scriptures and get an understanding of what God himself, through the writers of inspired scripture, actually say that would help us shape our understanding of abortion and whether it is acceptable or not. So let me first start off with Psalm chapter 127 and verses 3 through 5. And it says, "Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord," or of God himself, of Yahweh, "and the fruit of the womb is his reward." So children, children that are given to parents, they are the reward of God. They are the heritage of God. So if children are the heritage of God, why would we think that God would be okay with us squandering, killing, harming, destroying the heritage that he has given us? Verse number 4. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. You know, those pesky, annoying 2-, 3-, 4-year-old children. Yes, they can be difficult. I admit it, of course. They're, you know, children, you know, as cute as they are, can have their difficulties. That's why there is this controversy in the first place. But what does God say? As arrows in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. So as a man, as a warrior is preparing for battle, he wants to make sure he has arrows that are primed and ready, shaped and sharp, ready to shoot and aim at the target. And so the mighty man is drawing from a source for his victories. And so children of the youth are as arrows in the hand of a mighty man? Well, even if we don't understand how that works, we know that God has told us this, and children of the youth are those whom God has rewarded us with and has bestowed upon us the duty to shape them into something that will hit the target, that will win victories for us and for God. Verse number 5, happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. And so, the way we can actually deal with fellow human wars, fellow human beings, and deal even with ending wars depends on people being willing to fill their quiver with mighty arrows, which are their own children. If parents can actually focus on the duty and the reward that God has given them to raise children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, these children will go on even to speak with enemies in the gate. They can make relationships and possibly prevent some wars, because wars come from selfishness. But what do children do? Children require a lot of needs, and children are someone that require parents to think in a future-oriented fashion. Parents are young adults. If young adults are really trying to think more of their careers and not really of raising a family, they're mostly focused on themselves. But if they're thinking of the future, children can improve the future. The next passage, the next verse I'd like to look at is Job chapter 31 and verse 15. And Job says, "Did not he," referring to God, "did not he that made me in the womb make him? And did not one fashion us in the womb?" So, referring to God, he said that God makes us in the womb. So if God is fashioning us in the womb, not merely outside the womb, then why would we think that God would treat the fruit of the womb, the heritage that he has given us, as something that we can dispose with out of convenience? The next verse, Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 19. "I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing." This is God speaking to the Israelites. But God tells them, "Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed," or thy children, "may live forever." So what is God telling us? Death or life? Choose life. I mean, there's bumper stickers. There's even license plates, at least here in Colorado. I know that some people don't like those license plates, but you can get license plates that actually say "Choose Life" on them. And that, you know, actually seems like it would come right out of Deuteronomy 30, verse 19. "Therefore, choose life, that both thou and thy children may live." So what should be our slant, our angle, our understanding of how we should treat and how we should treat life, our lives, and how we should choose, look at how we should look at life and death? Well, God says, "Choose life, that both we and our children may live." So that doesn't seem to be very, very friendly to abortion now, does it? Choose life, that both you and your children may live. Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 5, God speaking to the young Jeremiah, who's a young man at this point, and God is telling Jeremiah about the mission that God has prepared for him to speak to the Israelites. And God says, "Before I formed thee in the belly," or in the womb of your mother, "before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee, and I ordained thee a prophet unto the nations." So when Jeremiah was in the womb of his mother, it says that before he came out of the womb, God had sanctified him. God had set him apart and ordained him to be a prophet to the nations, and first of all to the nation of Israel. But before God formed him in the womb, he knew him. That sounds like Jeremiah had to have been a person in the womb. And so God is the one who forms us in the womb, and God is the one who knows us as persons in the womb. Exodus chapter 21 and verses 22 through 25. This is part of the law that God gave Israel. Now, this is not talking about an abortion procedure, but the effect is the same, if even by some kind of accident that resulted from violence. So let me read this and explain. It says, "If men strive," or if there are two men or so on, two or more men that are fighting, "if men strive and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit or her child depart from her," in other words, it causes the child to be stillborn, "and yet no mischief follow," or no death follows, "he shall surely be punished." He shall be surely punished. This is talking about the one who hits the pregnant woman. "He shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judge is determined." So if there's a man who accidentally hits a pregnant woman and it causes the child to come out, but the physicians determine that no harm actually came to the child was born, the child lives, then the one who did that still needs to be punished, but the punishment will vary, and it actually depends on the husband and the judge to agree on it. I mean, so even that could be pretty severe. Okay, next verse. "And if any mischief follow," or if the child gets hurt or is killed, "thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe." So what is God saying? If two men were fighting, physically fighting each other, and one of them somehow in the process, maybe out of anger, to spite the other man, hurts his pregnant wife, or I don't know, it doesn't even say if it's accidentally or on purpose, but nevertheless, this is the value that God placed upon the child in the womb. So if the child is alive but is harmed as a result of the mother being hurt, whatever harm was done to that child should be the punishment to the man who hit the pregnant woman. So if it caused the child to, you know, have a blind eye, then that the punishment for the one who hit the pregnant woman would be to blind his eye. Or if it caused the child to be stillborn, in other words, be killed, then that man would be put to death. Now, that might seem harsh now, wouldn't it? But that shows that God is placing the same value upon the child in the womb as he does a person outside the womb. So it's even scales here. Whatever harm befalls the child befalls the person who hit a pregnant woman. So reading this account in the law that God gave to Israel, it doesn't seem like God would be perfectly fine with someone an abortion. God would not be fine with disposing of a fetus in the womb, whether by a tool or by hitting a pregnant woman, now would it? So those are some scriptures. There are other scriptures that are actually friendly to the pro-life position that would seem to be not very friendly to the practice of abortion. So given that, we can move on to some early church fathers and some early church writings to see what was the consensus in the early church regarding the topic of abortion. Now, although abortion is not specifically mentioned in the Bible, even those who, not long after the time the New Testament was written, would understand what the Bible actually meant and how we should treat children in the womb. So the first writing I want to look at is what is called the Didache. Now, this is Didache is a Greek term for it means like a teaching, basically how to disciple someone. So this was a discipleship document or manual that was actually written by Jewish Christians, and it was written anywhere from around AD 70 to 150. So that's quite a date range, but that entire range is, you know, rather early in the whole spectrum of things considering church history. So this portion of the Didache, this very short portion I am going to read, this is the Didache chapter 2 and verse 2. It says, "You shall not murder a child by abortion, nor kill that which is born." So there's an equation there. If a child is born, and now the pagans at the time, the Romans, did practice infanticide. Like, say, the child born was a girl, and the husband wanted a boy to continue his legacy, then perhaps some murder would occur, but according to the discipleship of early Christians, you don't kill that which is born, and you don't murder, using the word murder, a child by abortion. And for all of these quotes, these portions of writings from early church history, I will provide links to all of these sources in the show notes for this episode. So after the Didache, I'm going to move on to something called the Epistle of Barnabas, or the Letter of Barnabas. Now, this wasn't the same Barnabas who was a companion of Paul during his missionary journeys. This was another Barnabas. I mean, Barnabas was sort of a common name at the time. So this writing called the Letter of Barnabas, now this was written around the same time as the Didache, a similar time range, anywhere from AD 70 to 132. The Epistle of Barnabas says, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor more than thine own soul. Thou shalt not murder a child by abortion, nor again shalt thou kill it when it is born." Sounds similar, doesn't it? "Thou shalt not withhold thy hand from thy son or daughter, but from their youth thou shalt teach them the fear of God. This is chapter 19 and verse 5 of the Epistle of Barnabas. So, right after telling us that we should love our neighbor more than our own soul, which can be hard for many of us self-centered people, right after telling us about loving our neighbor, it says not to murder a child by abortion or kill it when it is born. So, the child in the womb, for all intents and purposes, is our neighbor. Just like Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. And by implication, the Epistle of Barnabas understands it is love your neighbor more than your own soul, because we have in other writings from the Bible that we are to treat, like in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3, let each esteem other better than themselves. So we should treat our neighbor even better than we treat ourselves. And who is our neighbor? Do not murder a child by abortion, nor again, don't kill it when it is born. And do not withhold your hand from your son or daughter. So not only should we not kill our children in the womb or out of the womb, but from their youth we will teach them the fear of God. So we have a duty not only to not kill them, but also to provide for them and to teach them the truth. Now, next, the letter to Diognetus. This is somewhere, there's quite the date range from scholars, anywhere in the second, from the second to the third century. The letter to Diognetus says, referring to, now the writer is listing a bunch of things where he's saying the similarities between Christians and the cultures in which they live. Not, you know, Christians are modest, but they still appropriate like the attire and the customs of the cultures in which they live that do not have to do with being immodest or immoral. So the letter to Diognetus says they, referring to Christians, marry like all other men and they beget children, but they do not cast away their offspring. So unlike pagans, Christians do not cast away their offspring. They actually see their offspring, as we saw in the Bible, the heritage of the Lord, and we do not cast them away for our own intentions, for our own conveniences, for the sake of our own wealth. Next, Athenagoras of Athens. He was an apologist who lived in the Greek city of Athens, where a lot of Greek culture would be. And Athenagoras wrote this in somewhere. He lived from 133 to about 190 AD. So sometime during his life here, this was probably actually written around 176 AD. So getting in the, you know, the third quarter of the second century AD, Athenagoras said, "And when we say that those women who use drugs to bring on abortion commit murder and will have to give an account to God for the abortion, on what principle should we commit murder?" So he's equating abortion with murder. "For it does not belong to the same person to regard the very fetus in the womb as a created being and therefore an object of God's care, and when it has passed into life to kill it, and not to expose an infant, because those who expose them are chargeable with child murder, and on the other hand, when it has been reared, to destroy it. But we are in all things always alike and the same," in other words, we're consistent, "submitting ourselves to reason and not ruling over it." So this is from chapter 35 of the writing that Athenagoras wrote. Chapter 35 is called "The Christians Condemn and Detest All Cruelty," and this is in his work called A Plea for the Christians. So what is Athenagoras saying? He's saying you don't expose an infant. So in other words, if somehow you were to expel a living child out of the womb forcefully to get it out, and then if it's still alive, you don't care for it, and then it naturally dies because it's dependent, that's the same as murdering it. You don't drink things to try to get the child to die in the womb. He calls that commit murder. Use drugs to bring on abortion, commit murder. Next, we move on to Tertullian. Tertullian lived anywhere, was born in about 160 AD and died in about 220 AD. So mid-second century to early third century. Now, from Tertullian's work, Apology, Chapter 9, this is what Tertullian had to say about abortion. In our case, abortion being once for all forbidden, we may not destroy even the fetus in the womb. While as yet the human being derives blood from other parts of the body for its sustenance, to hinder a birth is merely a speedier man-killing. Nor does it matter whether you take away a life that is born or destroy one that is coming to the birth. That is a man which is going to be one. You have the fruit already in its seed. Now, remember that Mr. Irving pointed out the concept of quickening in the colonies. So quickening was the term in which the parents were had the evidence, as we shall say, that there was a living child in the womb because the mother felt the baby kick. And Mr. Irving argues that because there is this concept of quickening, that it was okay to kill the child in the womb before this point in time. Now, actually, the same philosophy existed in the early church. There were even early Christians who just, you know, out of ignorance, out of the understanding of the day, I mean, they didn't have ultrasounds, they didn't have modern diagnostic ultrasounds, as Mr. Irving has told us. They did not have that. They couldn't see into the womb. And so all they could do was speculate. Because, you know, obviously, if you were to cut open a mother and, you know, the fetus were to die, how can you tell when this child forming in the womb was actually given life? And so some Christians followed the philosophers and believed that at some point in pregnancy, God bestowed life. But did this mean that they thought it was okay to remove a fetus before some arbitrary point in the pregnancy, such as maybe quickening, where it was obvious that there was a living child? No. Tertullian said, that is a man which is going to be one, and you have the fruit already in its seed. So he's making the case that even if life was not present yet, you still don't destroy the fetus in the womb because you're taking away what would have come to life, and it's still murder, even according to Tertullian's understanding. Now, another writing from Tertullian, from chapter 25 of Tertullian's work On the Soul, he says, accordingly, among surgeons' tools, there is a certain instrument which is formed with a nicely adjusted flexible frame for opening the uterus, first of all, and keeping it open. It is further furnished with an annular blade, by means of which the limbs within the womb are dissected with anxious but unfaltering care. Its last appendage being a blunted or covered hook, wherewith the entire fetus is extracted by a violent delivery. Does this sound familiar to anyone listening to this? This was an actual abortion procedure during the time of Tertullian. There is also another instrument in the shape of a copper needle or spike by which the actual death is managed in this furtive robbery of life. They give it, from its infanticide function, the name of Euboropsoktes, that's a Greek word, the slayer of the infant, that's what that word meant, the slayer of the infant, which was, of course, alive. So what is Tertullian is describing an abortion procedure. He says it's the fetus is extracted by a violent delivery, and the instrument is called, in the Greek, it means the slayer of the infant, and he says it was alive. And so Tertullian, describing this practice by the pagans of his day, on his work called On the Soul, is talking about how this kills an infant. And of course, we've already seen from Tertullian that getting rid of an infant in the womb intentionally is murder. Here's another quote from Tertullian's On the Soul. This is from chapter 27. Now we allow that life begins with conception, because we contend that the soul also begins from conception, life taking its commencement at the same moment and place that the soul does. So there were Christians at the time of Tertullian who believed that life possibly began later in the womb, but there were other Christians who believed that life began with conception. Tertullian was one of them. But for Tertullian, it didn't even matter if it begins at conception or later. Intentionally removing the fetus from the womb is murder. Hippolytus of Rome was another apologist from the 2nd to 3rd centuries. Hippolytus of Rome, born 170 AD, died around 235 AD. From chapter 7 of book 9 of his work called Refutation of All Heresies. So this was quite the work that Hippolytus of Rome wrote against everything he can think of that was taught by non-Christians. He wrote, "Whence women, reputed believers, began to resort to drugs for producing sterility, and to gird themselves around, so to expel what was being conceived on account of their not wishing to have a child, either by a slave or by any paltry fellow, for the sake of their family and excessive wealth. Behold, into how great impiety that lawless one has proceeded, by inculcating adultery and murder at the same time." So I don't know if the lawless one is referring to the woman or to a man that pressures a woman. So the man would cause the woman to engage in adultery, a harlot here, but then also to cause these women to either tie something really tight around their belly so as to basically suffocate the child from being able to be nourished, or to drink poison, as was a common method at the time for trying to induce abortions. Either way, this is murder, according to Hippolytus. Basil of Caesarea, from 330 to 379 AD, in chapter 2 of his work, letter 188, says, "The woman who purposely destroys her unborn child is guilty of murder." How is that for being clear? With us, there is no nice inquiry as to its being formed or unformed. In this case, it is not only the being about to be born who is vindicated, but the woman in her attack upon herself, because in most cases, women who make such attempts die. This is because of poison and so on that can actually harm the mother when trying to get rid of the fetus. The destruction of the embryo is an additional crime, a second murder, at all events if we regard it as done with intent. See, the issue is with intent. Some pro-abortion people try to say that pro-lifers believe that, you know, we want to set up cameras in people's houses to try to make sure and watch and see if a miscarriage is going to happen, and then try to throw these women into court and try them for murder if a miscarriage happens, or if, say, a woman trips and falls down the stairs. Oh, we got it on camera. Got to make sure we save those unborn. No, pro-life people are not arguing for that kind of thing. We're just saying, just as much as killing someone outside the womb with intent, and then if you happen to be caught, the trial should be a charge of murder. And the same thing here is that if you intentionally get rid of a child in the womb, it is murder. And notice that Basil of Caesarea said that there is no convenient inquiry as to its being formed or unformed. So he's saying we're not trying to split hairs here and figure out when does it start forming? When does it have life? It doesn't matter for Basil of Caesarea. You don't try to destroy your unborn child. Gregory of Nyssa, from 335 to 395 AD, from his work On the Soul and the Resurrection, says, "Whereas there is no question about that which is bred in the uterus, both growing and moving from place to place, it remains therefore that we must think that the point of commencement of existence is one and the same for body and soul." So Gregory of Nyssa believed that life began at conception, and that what is in the uterus is growing and moving, and so therefore has a soul. And so if killing a person outside the womb is destructive of someone made in God's image who is provided a soul from God, then that which is moving and inside the uterus has a soul just the same. And so therefore would be regarded as the with the same personhood and humanity as someone outside the womb. John Chrysostom, 349 to 407, from his work, Homily number 24 on the Book of Romans, said, "Why so where the ground makes its care to destroy the fruit? Where there are many efforts at abortion? Where there is murder before the birth? For even the harlot thou dost not let continue a mere harlot, but makest her a murderess also. You see how drunkenness leads to whoredom, whoredom to adultery, adultery to murder, or rather to a something even worse than murder. For I have no name to give it, since it does not take off the thing born, but prevent its being born. Why then do you abuse the gift of God and fight with his laws and follow after what is a curse as if a blessing and make the chamber of procreation a chamber for murder and arm the woman that was given for childbearing into slaughter?" Now, this is pretty clear what John Chrysostom is talking about here. Is saying that the ground is comparing the womb to ground that makes its care for growing fruit. And he's saying, why do you sow into the ground where it makes its care? Why do you sow it there to destroy the fruit? So John Chrysostom believed that the womb was supposed to be a place to protect children and not to destroy them, because the womb was designed by God. Just like the ground is made for growing fruit, you are a murderer if you intentionally destroy that which is sown into the womb. Augustine of Hippo, this is going to be the last early church father, before we end this episode, Augustine of Hippo, he lived from 354 to 430 AD. So from chapter 17 of his book 1 of his work On Marriage and Concupiscence, Augustine said, "Having also proceeded so far, they are betrayed into exposing their children, which are born against their will. They hate to nourish and retain those whom they were afraid they would beget. This infliction of cruelty on their offspring, so reluctantly begotten, unmasks the sin which they had practiced in darkness and drags it clearly into the light of day. The open cruelty removes the concealed sin. Sometimes, indeed, this lustful cruelty, or, if you please, cruel lust, resorts to such extravagant methods as to use poisonous drugs to secure barrenness, or else, if unsuccessful in this, to destroy the conceived seed by some means previous to birth, preferring that its offspring should rather perish than receive vitality, or if it was advancing to life within the womb, should be slain before it was born. So interestingly, if we notice what he just said, preferring that its offspring should rather perish than receive vitality, that could be referring to the fact that Augustine, following some early philosophers like Aristotle that believe that life in the womb maybe have actually began around 40 days past conception. Augustine is who entertained this idea from philosophy that life may have begun at some point during pregnancy, said that those who abort would prefer that its offspring should rather perish than receive vitality. And then he says, or if it was advancing to life within the womb, should be slain before it was born. So Augustine actually makes the equation between killing something or destroying something even before it is granted life, in his understanding, to something having life and killing it before it's born. So in Augustine's understanding that maybe life came somewhere during pregnancy, it doesn't matter for Augustine whether you kill it or destroy it before it has life, or you kill it once it gets life before it's born. It's all wickedness, according to Augustine. It's lustful cruelty, it's carelessness, and using poisonous drugs to secure barrenness. This was commonly done early in pregnancy. So, according to Augustine, it doesn't matter. Any method used to try to remove a fetus is the same as murder. So, not all of the church fathers understood when life actually began in the womb. But what is clear from the early church writings, there was a consensus, believe me, I found nothing in researching any Christian writing that granted any kind of okayness, as it were, to abort at any time during pregnancy. Even the early church fathers, who might have fallen in line with what would develop into the quickening understanding of the colonial Americans, even they believed that it was murder to remove or kill the fetus before it had ensoulment or life, even if that were granted by God at some point in the middle of pregnancy, or, you know, between conception and the middle, or what have you. It doesn't matter. According to Christians, you do not intentionally kill or expose or destroy the fetus in the womb. That is murder. So, I hope this provides a helpful backdrop from the early Christians, even before you had some kind of formalized Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox organized churches, as we would kind of observe from history, before you had anything that was a state church or an empire church or what have you. These were all writers during a time where you did not have an empire or Christians dictating out to the populace by means of the sword to live as Christians. These were not Christians imposing laws on pagan civilians. In fact, these were Christians who were civilians living in a culture that was hostile to Christianity. And yet, this is what the Christians had to say about abortion. And whether even life began at some point during pregnancy didn't matter. So what happens then if we discover that life begins at conception, by something that Mr. Irving calls modern diagnostic ultrasound, don't you think that would just merely confirm what these early Christians were talking about, that you do not intentionally destroy the child in the womb? As God has said in his word, children are an heritage of the Lord, of Yahweh, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. So, next episode, I mentioned we're going to look at colonial America and see if Mr. Irving's concept of quickening and this understanding of abortion rights in the early American colonies is actually true, or is it more of Mr. Irving's abortion fiction?
Thank you for waking up with Truthspresso. Good morning, and God bless your day.
Hey friends, Daniel Minnick here again. If you liked waking up to this episode of Truthspresso, I would really appreciate it if you would rate it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever application you use to listen to Truthspresso.